Welcome to Unabridged, the weekly podcast where four teachers take on books. We're your hosts. I'm Sarah, and I'm here with Jen, Ashley, and Jenny. We'll chat about our book club's pick of the month, discuss selective young adult novels, recommend related books, and share our nerdy English teacher love of reading. To follow along with our schedule, visit our website, unabridgedpod.com. You want opinions about books? We've got them.
Hey, it's Ashley. Today we're discussing Dane Hugglebridge's Castle of Water. It's the story about two strangers, Barry and Sophie, who are on a small plane that crashes into the ocean. They end up on a small deserted island where they have to learn to survive and to live together. So, Sierra, what did you think about the book?
Well, I love this book. I'm the one that nominated it for our book club because I read it and I just fell in love with the characters. I love the story. And what I really liked is Barry and Sophie. They are the main characters. They were just, I just loved them. I loved that Sophie was like a spitfire and she just was like, wasn't having him at all. And just basically cursed him in French all the time. And he was like, I don't know what to do. I just loved their whole dynamic. And I loved it. There's so many things I loved. Mm-hmm. Mostly their relationship really touched me and the way it developed over the years they were on the island. If I had to say my initial liking of the novel, that would be what it would be, is their relationship and the way they connected and interacted throughout mm-hmm. the years.
Yeah, this is Jenny, and I have to be honest, Sarah recommended it to us, and I'm happy to read whatever. And I got it, and I thought, oh, I don't know what I'm going to think about this. I just didn't know.
Yeah.
I totally loved it. It brought out tears at the end. I laughed out loud. And for me, with all the books that I read, when I find a book that either makes me laugh or cry, like, mm-hmm. there's something magic happening. And for both, like, that's amazing, I think. So I loved their relationships. I thought the characters were really strong. I even really like the way the story was told, which I know we'll get into, mm-hmm. but I think, like, there was mm-hmm. nothing about this book I didn't like. Yeah. I loved it.
Yeah, this is Jen. I totally agree. I just thought the writing was beautiful. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was looking back at my highlights to prep for today, and there were just so many individual sentences that didn't do anything to advance the plot, but they were just so well written and so mm-hmm. lovely. And so I thought that was a really nice element as well, in addition to the plot being compelling and yes. so caring mm-hmm. about the characters. Yes. And I also cried. I told our book club, my husband had gone upstairs to get our boys ready for bed, and he came downstairs because he heard me crying as I was finishing the book, and he said, oh, it's just your book. Oh. But I was just, like, sobbing, which I guess we should have warned about spoilers. I was so glad Sarah recommended it.
Yeah, this is Ashley, and I was really captivated from right at the beginning. Some of the things that people at book club commented on that they didn't necessarily love were, like, the use of French mm-hmm. and some of the things that you didn't mm-hmm. know and so maybe felt outside of. But, like, right away when it was set in Paris, when he was at Père Lachaise to see the, to the cemetery in the very beginning, like, right away, like, I mean, I'm very nostalgic for Paris, and so, like, right away, like, that was all very desirable to me. The setting was desirable, the way that it was sort of that outside perspective in the beginning mm-hmm. toward the man, mm-hmm. And he was unnamed, but sort of interesting, and then the, you know, art students were seeing him, and that whole setup was just really interesting, and I knew nothing about the book ahead of time, so then to jump from that mm-hmm. into the plane and the crash and all that stuff, I just thought it was brilliant. I at book club, I commented on there's definitely some suspension of disbelief yes. as you get into, particularly with a lot of what happens at the end. Yeah, I won't get into other stuff because of spoilers. We can talk about more later. But, you know, there were some things like that I thought about, but mm-hmm. only, you know, I did not think in any way it hindered the enjoyment of the book. I mean, it was just really a phenomenal read, lovely language. And just so well-crafted. Mm-hmm. Like, I loved the way, I loved that movement, just like I was saying about the beginning. That continuing throughout where you went mm-hmm. back to the yeah. present, mm-hmm. back to him as an artist, and then, you know, jumped from there. And then I also loved the cosmic sort of narrator who had yeah. this whole insight onto, you know,
yeah.
unbeknownst to Sophie and Barry, right. and he would give all this yeah. information.
I love that kind of thing.
I just really enjoyed the commentary that provided.
I think, actually, I totally agree with you because I think in the hands of a lesser writer, mm-hmm. of a weaker author, this would have been a hot mess of a book.
Yes.
I mean, really.
Yes.
There is a lot to juggle here, but it was handled so beautifully. Mm-hmm. I never felt lost. Like, at the beginning, with the man that was unnamed, I knew it would fit somehow, but I was kind of like, where are we going here?
Uh-huh.
Because it didn't fit with what the book jacket says, that there
right.
was this plane crash. So I was still interested, but I didn't know quite what was going on. But, I mean, I think it was masterfully written. Mm-hmm. Really, I'm very impressed.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, I agree. And I feel like I have not ever read a book that was exactly this way.
Mm-hmm.
And when I, kind of like you said, Jenny, when I first heard about it, I was like, Castaway Story? No, that is not my cup of tea. I don't do that, you know? And then I kept hearing all these good things about it. And so after I read it, I just fell in love. But I thought that, like you said, that it was just the way he executed his writing mm-hmm. and the story. And I just wonder, like, how does an author weave this, a story like this? Because it seems so, it's so intricate. And, like, one misstep, like you said, could have been a hot mess.
Absolutely.
When I do wonder, we talked about this a little bit at book club as well. Like, I felt like you had this great Victorian it reminded me of that narrator. Like,
that
speaking
sort of
to us,
narration. Yeah.
You know, bringing in all these little bizarre facts that all come together to just enrich the story. Which is really fun. I mean, there's no direct, like, dear reader moment or anything, but it was kind of Victorian. But
I never thought that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I must have missed. I came in late to book club, so I might have missed that part. But I never thought that. That's interesting, because Victorian is not a time period that I would say I'm very strongly familiar with.
I had a class in grad school, and that's all we were. Yeah, it was Victorian lit.
Okay.
So I read a lot there for a while.
It's something that a lot of times I don't enjoy, like that type of narration. And in this setup, it did really enhance it, that ability to step beyond.
Yeah.
And part of that, I think, was because they were castaways on an island.
Right.
So,
there's only so much.
That's true.
Sometimes it was nice to have this commentary that was outside of, you know, the two people on the island that we're spending a lot of time with. But I just thought it, so if, just like you all were saying, that a lesser author, I don't think, could have handled that very well, but it really enriched the story.
I often think one of those types of narrators, you don't feel like you're connected to the characters as much. But that's what he did so well, is you just feel this connection with these characters. And they have attributes that I can relate to. Like Barry, we talked about this in book club, but Barry has only a few sets of contact lenses. And me being a person who cannot see anything without my contacts, like, it made me feel like I was going to suffocate thinking that, and he was so haphazard going to sleep in them, and I want to be like, take out the contacts. Like, the whole, every time they mention it, I'm like, stop, you're just being so willy-nilly with these things that help you see, and he was blind without them.
Yes.
And so, I love you said before, you like, I mean, I know he has a lot of things to do, but he kind of doesn't have a lot of things to do, so the least he can do is remember, take out the contacts.
True.
Like, yes, he has to survive, but it's a pretty short list every day and a lot of hours in the day.
Well, and I did every time one popped out. I found myself, and I'm not convinced. I wanted to go back and look, and I did not. I'm not convinced that he didn't put in more than three sets of contacts over the course of the novel.
I wondered that too.
Yeah. Because I felt like they were popping out an awful lot. And he would
put had those saline solutions so that he kept making them last with, you know, cleaning it out and everything. But yes.
And there was at least one time that one popped out and he replaced the whole set. And I was like, dude, you have got to hold on to every contact lens.
Focus, buddy.
Well, so that's a perfect example of you have to suspend your disbelief.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because,
absolutely.
I mean, really, for them to survive on this island for the period of time that they did, and he only has, like, the three pairs, aside from my anxiety shooting out the wazoo, I mean, I was like, dude, this is so bad for you. But you have to sort of be able to be like, okay, within the world that this author is creating for us, I'm on board, right?
Yeah.
Because outside of you can say, like, no.
Right.
Three sets of contacts are never going to last this long. But if you're willing to go with that, if you're willing to kind of buy in, it works.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say that I think all of that enriches the character.
Yes.
Because, you know, you do think, oh, he didn't have to be blind. I mean, he didn't have to be so close to blind or so unable to function without. But, it, you know, bringing it up all the time enriched how we understood. Right.
Yeah.
You know, enriched how we understood his character. And there was always this idea of sort of the cosmic effect and that there was some, for better or worse, intervention happening.
Right.
And so, you know, that moment where he realizes the contacts are floating in the water, and he's like, well, okay, I'm going to take those and see what happens, I guess.
There was a beautiful, too, integration of the art installation. So in the present day, Barry's off the island in Paris, and there are these art students who go and they see this big art installation mm-hmm. that he has created. And it has all of these little details. And at the time, you just think it's part of the art. But then as the story goes on, I love the way some of those details came back up. And yes. you understood why he would include that in the art. So that was just one more of those times. Yeah. Like, I asked this question, and I don't know the answer, but it would be interesting to know how much the book was planned mm-hmm. and plotted, and how much of that just happened naturally, or did he have to go back? I think actually you said that yesterday. Did he have to go back and add in? Because it really had a lot of strands that worked together beautifully.
Yeah, agreed.
That's what I loved. I was just, when you said that about the art installation, mm-hmm. it just reminded me of, so the student who went and looked at the art installation and is moving through the museum, and I just loved this quote. She'd like to give those masterpieces her undivided attention, but the hem of her thoughts is still snagged on the hooked nail of his work. Mm-hmm. Those haunting so black and white paintings of the island, frightening in both their scale and their beauty, and that strange floating mogul with all the fish hooks. And so, I mean, I just, like, that language and just the way that those, you know, she's a very minor character, but yet shows the impact of the work.
Yes.
And then the part where she sees the mother and child, mm-hmm. Which again, you know, you see that way earlier on in the novel than when we get to the end. So I love the way it presents the foreshadowing and helps us understand how the story comes together, but also the way that it shows how he as an artist impacts all these other people and that power.
It's interesting because now it strikes me, I would like to go back and reread it now because on a second read, I bet I'm going to make a lot more connections, even though I appreciated it the first time. Absolutely. Right. Now I think I'll see a lot more of those little, like the mobile of fish hooks.
Yeah.
I don't know if I really caught that the first time. I mean, I read it, but I don't know that really struck me.
Right.
But now it really does because I'm on the other side of it. So I think this book would hold up to a reread very well.
Yes, right. Definitely.
Yeah. One thing that I was really struck by was the way the story was told. I mentioned at book club that it reminded me a little bit of Paul Harvey. For anybody in the audience mm-hmm. who's old enough to remember Paul Harvey, he would talk on the radio and his tagline was, now you know the rest of the story. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was, he's telling this story about Barry and Sophie and whatever's happening, and then the next chapter starts with some kind of historical reference or some kind of explanation. And at first, the first time it happened, I sort of thought, why are you telling us this? Mm-hmm. And then I realized he's bringing it back to a point. So the storytelling in such a positive way felt almost circular to me, like it's a spiral that he's revisiting the same different ideas and plot points, but at a different level, and everything weaves together so well. And I think that is really impressive because as soon as you figure that out, the detours did not feel like detours. Mm-hmm. They felt like they were filling in a really important part of the story that we wouldn't have known otherwise. Mm-hmm. Whereas sometimes with authors, you think, where are you going and why is this in here?
Right.
Because none of this felt that way to me.
And I thought, too, like, again, commenting on his writing skills is the restraint he showed, and I talked about this at book club, the restraint he showed in the development of Sophie and Barry's relationship. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, for a year, basically, or more than a year, she couldn't stand him. Yes. I mean, she basically tolerated him.
Yes.
I mean,
just barely.
I mean, because she was in mourning, and she was overcome with grief from having lost her fiance, and so I mean,
wasn't your husband?
Yeah, right.
They had just gotten married. Right. Sorry.
They had just gotten married. Yes, I mean, they were on their honeymoon, basically. Yeah. So.
Yes. Yeah, sorry. I don't know why.
No, that's okay.
So, but yeah, so she was grieving, and he let her. The character moved through the grief, which I appreciated. That he felt restrained and that he didn't just have them get together where that seems like that could have been the inclination to help the story move along.
Well, because her husband didn't just die, which he did die. He died tragically in front of her.
Yeah.
She was holding on to him, trying to save him.
Oh, I mean, so horrible.
Right, how do you just get over that?
No,
well, and I think one of the things that Hucklebridge introduces there is that idea that comes up several times of two paths, two choices. Mm-hmm. And so there's one place, this is near the end of the book, so this is definitely a spoiler, and it begins the chapter, the love of his life, Barry buried beneath the palm tree where they first had kissed, his living daughter now sleeping in the coconut wood cradle. Barry at last found himself alone on the beach, expelling the sobs he had stored for so long. And then I'm going to skip a little bit. And it says, two paths, white and shimmering as a summer day in Macoupin County, appeared before Barry. Amid his immense terror, depthless loss, and visceral sadness, a choice took shape. Suddenly his life was a fork in the road, a binary system both horrific and beautiful in its simplicity. And then it goes on to describe his two choices. And so it's interesting.
Can we please just read the rest of that? Because that might be my favorite part of the whole book.
One path was as follows. He could close his eyes, seize his struggle, and let his body go limp. He could stay on the island and watch with horribly compromised vision his child, their daughter, wail in pain and waste away without breast milk or formula, and then finally cease to breathe altogether. He could linger on, slowly succumbing himself to starvation or madness, until the day came when he no longer had the energy or will to rise from his sweat-stained pallet and face the growling incertitude of the day, at which point he, too, would give up the ghost. Or he could gather up his child, stock the canoe, and paddle like a mother.
I just think that is so beautiful.
Yeah, right. And that's not just because Ashley loves the F word.
Right.
There's so much more to it than that.
But that is beautiful.
And I just think in a book that it is so, so, so complex.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that at so many points, you have two choices.
Yes. And essentially, you can lay down and die.
Right.
Or you can get up and try to keep going.
But that,
and
I feel like that happened earlier in the book, too. Yes. With he had been gone.
Yes. When
he came,
on the...
Right? He had been out on the water, and then came back and saw Sophie basically ready to hang herself.
Yes.
Because she had given up on him because he'd been gone for so long. And it was the same thing.
Yes.
Had he been an hour later, she'd be dead.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, so there were so clearly different points where the story could have taken a totally different turn.
And I love that because I don't think, like, sometimes I think that seems like an oversimplification. But in these cases, it doesn't. Like, sometimes you have two choices.
Yes.
Right.
And you have just got to pick the one where you keep going no matter how hard it is.
Yes.
Right.
And the fact that most of the time when they did that, they felt such comfort and just such relief that, okay, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. and I think this idea that, like, even sort of in spite of themselves, that they have this endless will to live and, you know, this feeling that they've just decided. And that's what I was thinking. So part of my frustration toward the end was it's kind of like, if he figured out this stuff and he thought that they could paddle, then obviously they'd gone ahead and gone when she was pregnant, she would have lived.
Yeah.
And so then it frustrated me that they didn't make that risk, take that chance, especially with what Sophie knew about her uterus and the possibility that things were going to go badly.
Yeah.
And
spoiler alert, Sophie dies. No, it's good. It's not good that she died. Wrong, bad book. It's all good that we're talking about it, but I just feel like we need to acknowledge that, you know, it was tragic. And this is where I started crying.
Oh, my gosh. This is
I didn't
part
mean to interrupt you, actually. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I was just going to say, so I felt kind of hung up on that, but I was just looking back at a quote earlier than that that is similar, where, you know, they're talking about the choices, but it just says, as the denizens of the island, however, both Barry and Sophie had received a harsh lesson in its proper dimensions. They understood its elemental vastness. In different ways and at different times, they had both opted against the idea of suicide. Mm. Without any knowledge of where they were or where they might be going, venturing blindly into the blue yonder in search of new land seemed precisely that, suicidal. At least on their island, there was food to eat, water to drink, earth beneath their feet, and a place to bear witness to their fate. In short, there was something. Out there in the ocean, there was nothing. I mean, I think going back and looking at that, I do think he really sets up the fact that, I mean, that's why I loved that whole passage. Sorry to make you read the whole thing. But, I mean, I think that's why I loved it so much, because I felt like in that moment, he's lost everything but this brand new child.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now the only option is to go into the nothing.
Yes.
And to hope that there is something.
Right.
Because there's nothing left.
Because
whereas,
the guarantee,
like, so long,
it's a guarantee of nothing on the island.
I mean,
exactly.
Here's what it reminds
me of. And so
that's
believable to me.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of my favorite books ever is The Great Gatsby. And the final page in The Great Gatsby, I think, is one of the most beautiful things ever written. And it has the line, I wish I had it up in front of me, but about, we are boats borne back ceaselessly against the current. Like, and that is not an exact quote, I messed it up. But just that idea that we just keep hoping and dreaming and trying, and we know sometimes that we are not going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
But all that we do is we take power over the things that we can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that choice has value. mm-hmm. whether the choice works out or not. And you see, for Sophie, you know, there was one time that she was choosing death, right, when she was so desolate because she was convinced that Barry was dead. Mm-hmm. But there were so many other chances that she chose hope. Mm-hmm. And I think,
like the whole scene with Etienne and right? the fish. Yes. I mean, yeah. the shark.
Oh
I mean,
gosh.
Like,
yes.
I feel like that's a good time yeah. to just be like, well.
So I just think, yep. yes. I love that when yeah. it's not saying it's going to work out and be happily ever after.
Right.
It is saying that this choice has value whatever the end.
Although I yeah. did go back and reread, I don't know if anybody did. Somewhere as we were getting close to the end, I reread that first chapter to make sure that there was a child. Because I got very hung up on.
Oh, I didn't do that. That's interesting.
Because he pads down the hallway. I don't have it in front of me. But yeah. like he's padding down the hallway and he's listening at the door
and
before he goes out. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So like clearly there was someone there sleeping.
Oh, I did not remember that.
And I was like, surely that. You know, means that the child lives, but...
Well, and see, I yeah. thought, because I did not go back and reread it, but I remember that he debated leaving a note, and so at the end, I thought when the first baby was born dead, I was like, oh, Sophie's gonna live.
I did, too.
And so then...
that was heart-wrenching.
That was awful.
Yeah, and then when the second baby is born, I was like, oh, no. Well, I mean, and of course I was happy that the second baby,
I know.
I just had, I felt like somebody was going to die.
I think I thought, well, because, I guess because I reread, because I went back, I thought it was a child and not his spouse, because, like, she would be in bed with him, like, he wouldn't have gone down the hall or whatever, so I think I expected her to die, but it was so sad. I mean, again, because so preventable, and I loved, I felt like that was very clear in the book that, you know, again, our all-knowing narrator very insightfully tells us about how precisely easy it is to solve that problem in any hospital.
Right,
and,
yes.
You know, that's something they reach,
her decision not to tell him, because there was nothing they could do.
Yeah. Right.
So what's the value?
And again, I think,
worry?
In my opinion, they could have gotten in the boat. They had this amazing boat. They could have gotten in the boat and they could have tried to go somewhere. But I think, you know, rereading, I just feel like he does a really good job of arguing why that was not desirable to them and why it wasn't worth it.
I think that that's one of the things that helps with that suspension of disbelief, because everything felt... like it made sense. Like it was all very
it's at
believable.
Least plausible.
And so I think that was some of the way it was written. Things could happen the way they did because you were able to believe what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
The way it was written led you to what was going on. So.
Well, and I think when you have that kind of omniscient narrator, there's a feeling that there is a force that can make things that maybe aren't realistic happen.
Yeah.
And whether that you think that's God or, whatever you think that is, I didn't get the sense of that in this book. Mm-hmm. But it felt like there was this... I just kept thinking of destiny. Like,
yes,
there's
right.
feeling like there was this destiny and fate and, it
this
felt
sort of
mythological.
Cosmic aspect.
It was really interesting. Well, the whole thing, we haven't talked about each of their influences. The reason that they were on this plane in the first place was because they each had an obsession with an artist who was buried on a tiny island, and they were buried beside each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's one more coincidence that has brought them together.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really fascinating.
I think there was a lot of growth, too. Like, I loved... I think we saw so much more. Sophie, some, but I thought we saw a lot more with Barry, with his remembering about growing up and being in the farm and all that kind of stuff, and then wanting to do the art and not sure where it fit into his life. And I feel like I don't know if it's specifically in the book, but he talked somewhere or got the impression about going from being kind of a soft, middle businessman to becoming somebody who is living a life that, as odd as it might sound, on a deserted island. Where he's finding happiness and he's sort of creating his true purpose in life. And I appreciate it. I think we saw some of that with Sophie remembering her grandparents. It was a cabin, she called it, you know, where they would go in the mountains. But I feel like with Barry, it was so really clearly drawn out.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked seeing some of that growth. And
well,
some of the changes he made.
And his whole thing that he was a stockbroker and that he had hated it the whole time and that then he finally decided to leave it and pursue his art.
Gave all his money away.
He was really a fascinating
character.
Yes, he was. Yeah, I agree.
And I love that they kind of had, he was kind of the soft one in their relationship and she was kind of the no-nonsense. And he had to win her over.
Yes.
You know?
Well, and how much they needed each other. Like, I thought, you know, again, thinking about her architectural skills and his, like, all the things he had growing up, like, knowing how to fish and stuff like that, those played together so nicely. Yeah.
Except when he lost his contacts.
I know. That's so
the contacts were a huge thing. Like, you think it's a small thing, but it's this huge thing throughout the whole story.
Yeah.
I mean, him being able to see.
Well, and I liked that. I mean, again, I thought there was a time where I was kind of like, I don't know why this is such a big deal. Like, why make that? But I think it really showed him, it shaped his character a lot.
Right.
But also, I loved the part after he lost him
yes.
where he was like moping around and feels so useless. And she finally is like, get it together.
Yes.
Like, it is what it is. And you've done all these things for me all this time. And I'm going to do the parts that you've been doing because that's what we need to do.
Yeah.
Well, and that she was able to inspire him to enable her. Like, that has such strength. So you saw that he had become strong in all of these different ways. And that it wasn't all about him doing, but it was him. Because it talks about how at first he would have to lead her step by step through the fishing, casting the net and all that. And then eventually she can do it on her own, which is her triumph, but it's also his.
Yeah.
I mean, I think,
yeah.
It was just really
also,
great.
I'm sorry, but
no,
also the whole idea, which I found sort of almost amazing and hard to believe, but really believable in the way it was done, was that they were able to give each other gifts.
That's exactly
what
it
was.
I thought that was
that.
So sweet and amazing.
Yes.
And
that was so precious.
The idea, like, I thought at first, really, gifts? I mean, and then
well,
to see what the
stuff,
gift
I was like,
is.
Couldn't you have done it sooner?
Yeah.
But again,
right.
I think that setup of you don't do those things until there's nothing else. Or until in that moment, they both so desperately wanted to please the other person and do something loving for the other person that, like, that's what pushes
they
you.
They weren't
to
in
do
the
them.
Survival mode the same way.
That's right.
They'd figured out
that's
how to kind of survive already, so
and
now they could do that.
Well, they really were making a life on the island. And so, like, I mean, I know this, but when I was reading, I'm like, oh, I'm going to live on a deserted island. I mean, I don't really.
Right.
But I mean, like, they, like, to think that they only had each other to focus on.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then when she got pregnant and they were just so happy and they only had each other to focus on.
Oh,
there
the
was none of the
simplicity of it all.
The simplicity
really
was very
desirable
to
me.
I agree with that. And the thing is, I loved Sophie. You used the perfect word, Sarah. She was totally a spitfire.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Loved her, like, her passion and her energy. I love how she just kind of cussed him out. She didn't care about him at all. I mean, he was not her priority. Because the thing is, as someone who has in the past struggled with making sure people are happy and, like, harmonious and people-pleasing, I love that she doesn't give two rats about it. Like, she didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to take care of herself. But then I really grew to care for her. Like, when she tossed away her wedding ring.
Oh,
I mean, that was heartbreaking, I thought. Like, I really grew to care about both of them.
Yeah.
And I think that showed such depth of characters because she could have easily been one note.
Mm-hmm.
Just a smart-ass French girl.
Yes.
Who lost her husband and now is just bitter. And even if she had come around, that's all there was to her.
Right.
But she wasn't. There was so much more to her than that. And I really loved that.
Two things I was thinking about is, one is when she made the, like, nice living quarters with the roof, and then she made Barry's. I love that. I was, and he thought he was going to lay in there beside her, and she's like, no, you can have the hammock.
There's
a brain. And then the other thing I was thinking about, just as we were talking, like, the thing about this book is, like, the attention to the details are what makes this book so fantastic. Because just, like, the wedding ring thing and the gifts, the soap, and the I mean, it's just all the details he put in that he didn't really need to put in to move the plot forward, but that just
made
tugged
it real.
At your tugs at the heartstrings was just so powerful.
Well, that she didn't forget about her husband. I mean, I knew at the beginning she didn't, but that the idea of her finding love again, and that she has to let go of Etienne to then move on.
Yes.
And it wasn't just like, oh yeah, I was married and now he's dead. It was this process of, this was this person I was going to spend my whole life with, and I watched this tragic, horrible death. And I loved him, and he loved me, and nobody knows where we are, and nobody knows what's happened, but I'm going to make a choice. I mean, that's...
Again, there's the choice that Jenna's talking
about.
Yes,
that whole choice thing. I think that's it's perfect. I just...
Yes.
I don't
the
know,
more
I
we're
just,
talking about the book, the more I'm loving it.
And the more, like, I look back at the passages, I'm just like, oh
I know,
my
it's beautiful,
gosh,
yes.
It is just brilliant.
Well, I had
yes.
to stop at one point highlighting because I thought I can't highlight everything.
Right.
But it was like on
was
every
so
page.
Yeah.
There was a sentence that I just stopped for a second and just, you just wanted to read it.
And
like,
the thing is, it was dual layered. It was the actual construction of the sentences, the beautiful wording and the structure of the sentences, but it was also that every sentence had a purpose and worked together to weave this amazing tapestry of a story, because one or the other is good. Both together is a knockout. I mean, the fact that everything that was included felt purposeful and felt, even when you were sort of like, wait, why are we talking about, like, 500 years ago on some weird island somewhere. Yeah. But then you realize, oh, that's why we're talking about it. Okay. Yes. And it made sense. And it informed all of the different parts of the story. So, yeah, I hope he writes more soon. I would love to read something else.
I do too.
And I have to say one more thing. While I was reading it, I got so sick of bananas. Because all they talked about was bananas. And I was like, I don't think I like bananas anymore. And I didn't even have to eat them all. Going to move on to the pairing section of today's broadcast.
So this is Jen. I am pairing The Castle of Water with The Great Gatsby, which you all know is one of my very favorite books ever in the entire world. I taught it almost every year of my teaching career, and I reread it every year, and I loved it more every time I taught it. So one thing that I love about Gatsby is just the writing style. And just as Castle of Water has a very distinct writing style with just beautiful sentences that you can dive into, Gatsby does as well. Fitzgerald just was a perfectionist when it came to writing just the perfect sentence. He revised and revised and revised. And I think I see that in Castle of Water as well. There's also a really interesting sense of time. One thing that we talked about a lot in my class was the fact that Nick, the narrator of Gatsby, is looking back on something that happened and narrating it. And he plays a lot with time. So parts of it are chronological, but parts aren't. And he really brings nostalgia to the forefront, looking back at a time of his life with some regret, but also identifying what was hopeful about that time. And I think I see the same kind of, really consideration of time in Castle of Water. So I think those two, I think if you like Castle of Water, Gatsby would be a great choice.
This is Sarah, and weirdly, The Great Gatsby is not one of my favorites.
This is Jenny, and I would agree with that, and yet I'm so impressed with you.
I do understand what you're saying, but I just did not
I do like that, but I also do not love it with quite the same passion or intensity.
I do appreciate your passion and your intensity, because I do not have it for that book, so yay for you, because you kind of almost make me want to give it another try.
See, you should.
I don't know.
You might like it more now.
I don't know, but I admire you.
Well, I just have to say that my other book club just recently read that, and I did give it another try. Still didn't like it. Anyway, my pairing for this is Station 11by Emily St. John Mandel.
Oh, it's so good.
I love that one, too. I never read that one.
And this is a dystopian novel based on the premise that a virus or an illness has wiped out civilization as we know it.
Oh, wow.
And about this group of people, and it kind of goes back and forth between the present and the past, which that happens in Castle of Water. And but really what made me pick this book is the strong relationships in the book. I felt like Sophie and Barry's relationship in Castle of Water was just so much on the forefront. Mm-hmm. And when I think about that book, that's what I think about. Mm-hmm. And I also think about setting and how strong the setting was. And Station 11 was that way. The characters had really strong relationships, and it was terrifying at times for them, but it was also really tender and really heartfelt at times. And then the setting, of course, since it's a dystopian novel, the setting just plays this huge role in the way that they live their lives and how they conduct themselves. So that's my pairing for this particular novel.
That's a great one.
Awesome. I'll have to read that one.
Yeah, it does sound good.
Even if you don't like dystopian novels,
yes.
I think...
Which I love.
I do, too.
Yeah. It's already up my alley.
I like dystopian. I don't like fantasy, but because dystopian doesn't feel fantasy to me for the most part. You know what I mean? That's why I don't mind it.
Well, to me, Station 11 is eerily... it's set, so it's basically it takes you up to this certain point, and then something happens, and then civilization is wiped out. And as a reader, at least for me, when I was reading it, I'm like, this could happen. Yes. I mean, it's a little scary.
Yes.
So. Well, and I think the way that art is at the center of Castle of Water, I think literature and art and drama is at the center of Station
11.
Yes.
That
one.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Too. That sounds awesome. I'm going to check that out.
Yes. I have it if anybody wants to borrow.
I'd love to borrow
That's
it.
That's a yes.
Yeah. That sounds
sounds great. This is Ashley, and I wanted to talk about Cormac McCarthy and The Road.
Probably not mine, though.
Yeah, I like that one. Okay. Too. I like all of
Sorry,
her.
Ashley.
Sorry, go for it, Ashley.
Anyway, I will focus here and not digress into how much I love Cormac McCarthy, but I love Cormac McCarthy passionately. Anyway, so he is one of my most favorite authors, which if you checked out our website, you will know. And so I think the Road came to my mind because it is stylistically is very different from Castle of Water, but both of them have strong style, like Jen was talking about, the syntax and the author's choices. And in both cases, I mean, with McCarthy, it's just sparse language, bare sentences, lots of fragments. And that is the world that they live in. It is a father and his son, and they are in a post-apocalyptic world, and they're doing their best to survive in a space where most of humanity is gone.
Yikes.
And it's just them on a road. And I think
the
it
whole
just,
book is them on a road.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, and I did it with students, and sometimes people loved it, like me. Yeah. And other people were like, there's just ash and road and ash, and then they're not on the road, and then there's more ash.
I fear that might be me. I will have to
yeah.
see.
And yeah, there's truth in that. But it is really what I love about it is the tenderness of their relationship and the way that the father and son are each other's whole world. And I just felt like that reminded me, the Castle of Water reminded me so much of that with Barry and Sophie and how they were everything to each other. And all the feelings, everything that they felt was, you know, focused on this one person because they were so alone. And then just like you were saying, Sarah, about setting, that it was just really, you know, a very clear setting. And in The Road, it is bleak and barren, but the setting plays a very important part, just like their island is so important to them in Castle of Water. So I just felt like they're, again, stylistically very different, and the storylines are different in so many ways, but I felt like just the tenderness and the hopefulness and in a dire situation. I mean, that's what I love about The Road. Like, the kids were like, yeah, but there's ash in the road. And I was like, yeah, but there's this like endless hope in such a terrible place. And I just think it's such a testament to humanity. And that was what I loved in Castle of Water too, was just this feeling of like, I'm going to persevere. Like I have these two choices. I can lay down and die or I can get up and keep going. And just the way that people can persevere in a lot of ways, love is what enables them to persevere. Mm-hmm. I think that was what, that's what really
that
resonated.
It's really good
too.
Yeah. I'll have to try that one. It's beautiful. This is Jenny, and my pick is very much about the way the story was told, because one of the things that really struck me about Castle of Water was how it was very circular in a way, almost like you're kind of climbing a staircase and you're seeing, like if you're at a lighthouse and you're climbing, the windows are positioned at the same place that you see the same things, but just from a different level. So that's how this book felt to me in some ways, that it was like this aerial view of the story, and you kind of circled around, found out some background, came back to the story. Mm-hmm. My pick is Big Little Lies by Leanne Moriarty. And I have to be honest, I have not watched the Showtime, when they made it into a movie. I've heard great things.
Great.
I have not watched any of that because I'm very reluctant a lot of times to watch movies or shows made out of the books because I just have such a picture in my head of the book already. But I love in that book specifically, I mean, Leanne Moriarty is one of my very favorite writers. But in that book specifically, at the very beginning, you find out there's a murder. I mean, there's no spoiler there at all. But then there's kind of this almost circular unfolding of 6 months before and then 5 months before. And then you discover these extra parts that kind of get dropped in and you don't know where it goes because this little vignette doesn't seem to have anything to do with the murder, but oh, that's why we're finding this out. I think she is a brilliant, brilliant writer. And I just, the fact that the stories had that similarity to me in the way they were told, not at all really the content, but just the way that the stories unfolded, I immediately thought of her. I don't think that's an easy kind of story to tell, to get your readers to sort of follow with a non-linear narrative. I think that's harder.
Absolutely.
It requires a lot more work on the reader's part. And it's lucky if you have readers that want to do it, but when it's so masterfully done, it looks effortless. So definitely check that one out if you haven't.
That sounds great.
I listened to that one on audiobook, and it was not the most intuitive audiobook, I think, but it was really well done.
Did they have someone reading it with an Australian accent? I think I might have listened to it also, because she's also read the... shoot, the one about the husband's secret.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was the same reader, and she was very good in both of those. Awesome.
Okay, now we're going to talk about our classroom connections. So this is Jen. I taught high school. I would absolutely teach Castle of Water. I think the writing is strong. I think the story is strong. I think it would yield great discussion with a group. There are a couple of things that I might give kids warnings about. Some students who are really sensitive to particular topics or to explicit language might have a problem with it. But I think it would be well worth discussion. It would also be a great choice for lit circles. I don't know. What do you think, Ashley?
Yeah, I completely agree. Definitely with the older students, this would be a good fit. So 11 or 12, I would have it in more. I mean, it would be difficult for some of our students. So it'd be great in lit circles because we could differentiate and have some easier reads along with something like this that would be more challenging. And then also it could be taught whole class because I think it really stands up. It has some nice literary merit, and so it would be, you know, a good, there's a lot that you could analyze. I mean, just like in our discussion, I felt like, you know, we could have kept digging in to so much about, and just like you were saying, Jenny, about the way the narrative's structured and those kinds of things. Like, I feel like that stuff is really valuable for analysis as well. So,
writing.
It's just, I mean, the syntax is stunning. Like, I just think there's a lot that you can work through.
Yeah. And I think it's great to show kids that the only things worthy of analysis are not old.
Right.
And so I did teach classics, but I always tried to balance them with contemporary works, and I think this would be a great recent addition to any classroom's curriculum.
And just characterization. I mean, there's so much beautiful character development. So I think there's a lot that you could dig into like there.
The pacing of the plot and the way things are revealed. It's just so good.
It really would help with the idea of the omniscient narrator.
Yeah.
You know, kind of coming in and delivering. I mean, that could be a really great cool thing to look at.
I mean, I taught AP 1 year, and Ashley, you taught it longer than I did. I think this would be a great for the AP test.
Yeah, for the AP Lit, it would be, where I was always trying to choose things that worked really well for the open question, and this would work really nicely for that. Kids could write about it.
So Sarah and I both taught middle school. I did sixth grade, and so of course I would not put Castle of Water out. That's a duh. But I do have a book that I think is similar, which is Holes by Louis Sacker, and I love Holes so much. I read it out loud for so many years until the movie came out, and then I took a really long break because it's still an awesome book, but when kids would walk in, I saw the movie, I would just, it needed a break. But it is one of the most tightly written books I've ever seen, and it has that same concept of circular. What he does, though, is he weaves together those two entirely different stories. You know, so you know Stanley's story, but then you're also going back to the story of his no-good, dirty, rotten, pig-stealing great-great-grandfather, and both of those stories are unfolding, and then when they come together, it is just, like, it's almost majestic, which I know sounds ridiculous for a book, but it just, it's so beautifully written. And so it was all for me about the way the story was told. I mean, it's just a great story, but the similarity to the way Castle of Water was told, I would easily bring Holes out, and you could do so much with that.
That makes me want to reread that, because I've only read it
once. Oh, it's so good.
And I definitely read it the first time for a plot. Like, I was not reading for all those things.
I should add that on our website to my favorite books. All right, if it's not there on my website yet, it will be soon. I'm going to put it there.
Yes, I love that book. And we, as a family, listened to that this summer when we were on vacation, and everybody loved it. I have a 6-year-old, a 9-year-old. A 40-year-old and me, and we just enjoyed it so much. So I think that's a great choice. So I would also use that in my classroom. I also thought when Jenny was discussing about the nonlinear narrative, I thought about the Giver series by Lois Lowry. Like, she's the OG dystopian for a while.
Yes.
Don't you love that?
Yes. And because when all my kids started reading, when I was teaching in eighth grade, when all my kids started reading the dystopian novels, like The Hunger Games and the Matched series, which I love those, but I mean, really, Lois Lowry was doing it way before some of the more recent authors. So I thought The Giver really does take this these characters and creates these, and Lois Lowry creates these four books that have this thread of story in them, but there are also a lot of other things going on. And like you said, Jenny, it takes work as a reader, but it's a great kind of stepping off point for middle school students for that type of narrative structure. And so I think that would be a good...
Because that's an accessible, like, kids, middle school kids, aside from content, would struggle some with Castle of Water, the writing of it.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not impossible, but it's above them.
Most of them haven't even felt
that. Exactly. Yeah. But with The Giver, the thing is, it does have that structure, but it's attainable for kids. Yes. And they get exposed to it without even knowing until you draw their attention to it or use it for a lesson somehow. And then they're like, I never even... And it opens their eyes to the way stories can be told differently.
Yeah.
Which is a beautiful break from, hi, my name is, and I'd like to tell you a story.
Thanks for listening to Unabridged. Do you have comments or opinions about what you heard today? We would love to hear them. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at UnabridgedPod and on the web at unabridgedpod.com.